In a future America, the marathon is the ultimate sports competition, a novel of chilling, macabre possibility. The Long Walk by Richard Bachman, author of Rage. This is for Jim Bishop and Bert Hatlin and Ted Holmes. To me, the universe was all void of life or purpose, of volition, even of hostility. It was one huge, dead, immeasurable steam engine, rolling on in its dead indifference to grind me limb from limb. Oh, vast, gloomy, solitary Golgotha and mill of death! Why was the living banished thither companionless, conscious? Why, if there is no devil? Nay, unless the devil is your God. Thomas Carlyle. I would encourage every American to walk as often as possible. It's more than healthy. It's fun. John F. Kennedy, 1962. The pump don't work because the vandals took the handle. Bob Dylan. Part 1, Starting Out. Chapter 1. Say the secret word and win $100. George, who are our first contestants? George? Are you there, George?
Groucho Marx, you bet your life.
An old blue Ford pulled into the guarded parking lot that morning, looking like a small, tired dog after a hard run. One of the guards, an expressionless young man in a khaki uniform and a Sam Brown belt, asked to see the blue plastic ID card. The boy in the back seat handed it to his mother. His mother handed it to the guard. The guard took it to a computer terminal that looked strange and out of place in the rural stillness. The computer terminal ate the card and flashed this on its screen. Garrity Raymond Davis. Road 1, Pownall, Maine. Androscoggin County. ID number 49-801-89. Okay. The guard punched another button, and all of this disappeared, leaving the terminal screen smooth and green and blank again. He waved them forward.
Don't they give the card back? Mrs. Garrity asked. Don't they?
No, Mom, Garrity said patiently.
Well, I don't like it,
she said, pulling forward into an empty space. She had been saying it ever since they set out in the dark of 2 a.m. She had been moaning it, actually.
Don't worry, he said, without hearing himself.
He was occupied with looking and with his own confusion of anticipation and fear. He was out of the car almost before the engine's last asthmatic wheeze. A tall, well-built boy wearing a faded army fatigue jacket against the 8 o'clock spring chill. His mother was also tall, but too thin. Her breasts were almost non-existent, token nubs. Her eyes were wandering and unsure, somehow shocked. Her face was an invalid's face. Her iron-colored hair had gone awry under the complication of clips that were supposed to hold it in place. Her dress hung badly on her body as if she had recently lost a lot of weight.
Ray,
she said in that whispery conspirator's voice that he had come to dread.
Ray, listen.
He ducked his head and pretended to tuck in his shirt. One of the guards was eating sea rations from a can and reading a comic book. Garrity watched the guard eating and reading and thought for the 10,000th time, it's all real. And now, at last, the thought began to swing some weight.
There's still time to change your mind.
The fear and anticipation cranked up a notch. No, there's no time for that, he said. The back-out date was yesterday. Still in that low conspirator's voice that he hated,
they'd understand, I know they would. The Major
would, Garrity began and saw his mother wince.
You know what the Major would do, Mom.
Another car had finished the small ritual at the gate and had parked. A boy with dark hair got out. His parents followed, and for a moment the three of them stood in conference like worried baseball players. He, like some of the other boys, was wearing a light pack sack. Garrity wondered if he hadn't been a little stupid not to bring one himself.
You won't change your mind.
It was guilt. Guilt taking the face of anxiety. Although he was only 16, Ray Garrity knew something about guilt. She felt that she had been too dry, too tired, or maybe just too taken up with her older sorrows to halt her son's madness in its seedling stage.
to halt it before the cumbersome machinery of the state, with its guards in khaki and its computer terminals, had taken over, binding himself more tightly to its insensate self with each passing day, until yesterday, when the lid had come down with a final bang. He put a hand on her shoulder. "This is my idea, Mom. I know it wasn't yours. He glanced around. No one was paying the slightest attention to them. "I love you, but this way is best, one way or the other." "It's not," she said, now verging on tears. "Ray, it's not. If your father was here, he'd put a stop to..." "Well, he's not, is he?"
He was brutal, hoping to stave off her tears.
What if they had to drag her off?
He had heard that sometimes that happened. The thought made him feel cold. In a softer voice, he said, "Let it go now, Mom, okay?" He forced a grin.
"Okay,"
he answered for her. Her chin was still trembling, but she nodded. Not all right, but too late. There was nothing anyone could do. A light wind soughed through the pines. The sky was pure blue. The road was just ahead, and the simple stone post that marked the border between America and Canada. Suddenly his anticipation was greater than his fear, and he wanted to get going, get the show on the road.
"I made these. You can take them, can't you? They're not too heavy, are they?"
She thrust a foil-wrapped package of cookies at him.
"Yeah."
He took them, and then clutched her awkwardly, trying to give her what she needed to have. He kissed her cheek. Her skin was like old silk. For a moment he could have cried himself. Then he thought of the smiling, mustachioed face of the Major, and stepped back, stuffing the cookies into the pocket of his fatigue jacket. "Goodbye, Mom."
"Goodbye, Ray. Be a good boy."
She stood there for a moment, and he had a sense of her being very light, as if even the light puffs of breeze blowing this morning might send her sailing away like a dandelion gone to seed. Then she got back into the car and started the engine. Garrity stood there. She raised her hand and waved. The tears were flowing now. He could see them. He waved back, and then as she pulled out, he just stood there with his arms at his sides, conscious of how fine and brave and alone he must look. But when the car had passed back through the gate, forlornness struck him, and he was only a 16-year-old boy again, alone in a strange place. He turned back toward the road. The other boy, the dark-haired one, was watching his folks pull out. He had a bad scar along one cheek. Garrity walked over to him and said hello. The dark-haired boy gave him a glance.
"Hi."
"I'm Ray Garrity," he said, feeling mildly like an asshole.
"I'm Peter McVreeze."
"You all ready?" Garrity asked. McVreeze shrugged.
"I feel jumpy. That's the worst."
Garrity nodded. The two of them walked toward the road and the stone marker. Behind them, other cars were pulling out. A woman began screaming abruptly. Unconsciously, Garrity and McVreeze drew closer together. Neither of them looked back. Ahead of them was the road, wide and black.
"That composition surface will be hot by noon," McVreeze said abruptly. "I'm going to stick to the shoulder."
Garrity nodded. McVreeze looked at him thoughtfully.
"What do you weigh?"
160.
"I'm 167. They say the heavier guys get tired quicker, but I think I'm in pretty good shape."
To Garrity, Peter McVreeze looked rather more than that. He looked awesomely fit. He wondered who they were that said the heavier guys got tired quicker, almost asked and decided not to. The walk was one of those things that existed on apocrypha, talismans, legend. McVreeze sat down in the shade near a couple of other boys, and after a moment, Garrity sat beside him. McVreeze seemed to have dismissed him entirely. Garrity looked at his watch. It was 8:05. 55 minutes to go. Impatience and anticipation came back, and he did his best to squash them, telling himself to enjoy sitting while he could. All of the boys were sitting. Sitting in groups and sitting alone. One boy had climbed onto the lowest branch of a pine overlooking the road and was eating what looked like a jelly sandwich. He was skinny and blonde, wearing purple pants and a blue chambray shirt under an old green zip sweater with holes in the elbows. Garrity wondered if the skinny ones would last or burn out quickly. The boys he and McVreeze had sat down next to were talking.
"I'm not hurrying," one of them said. Why should I? If I get warned, so what? You just adjust, that's all. Adjustment is the key word here. Remember where you heard that first. He looked around and discovered Garrity and McBreeze. More lambs to the slaughter. Hank Olson's the name. Walking is my game. He said this with no trace of a smile at all. Garrity offered his own name. McBreeze spoke his own absently, still looking off toward the road. I'm Art Baker, the other said quietly. He spoke with a very slight southern accent. The four of them shook hands all around. There was a moment's silence, and McBreeze said, kind of scary, isn't it? They all nodded except Hank Olson, who shrugged and grinned. Garrity watched the boy in the pine tree finish his sandwich, ball up the waxed paper it had been in, and toss it onto the soft shoulder. He'll burn out early, he decided. That made him feel a little better. You see that spot right by the marker post? Olson said suddenly. They all looked. The breeze made moving shadow patterns across the road. Garrity didn't know if he saw anything or not. That's from the long walk the year before last, Olson said with grim satisfaction. Kid was so scared he just froze up at 9 o'clock. They considered the horror of it silently. Just couldn't move. He took his 3 warnings, and then at 9:02 a.m. they gave him his ticket, right there by the starting post. Garrity wondered if his own legs would freeze. He didn't think so, but it was a thing you wouldn't know for sure until the time came. And it was a terrible thought. He wondered why Hank Olson wanted to bring up such a terrible thing. Suddenly, Art Baker sat up straight. Here he comes. A dun-colored Jeep drove up to the stone marker and stopped. It was followed by a strange, tread-equipped vehicle that moved much more slowly. There were toy-sized radar dishes mounted on the front and back of this half-track. 2 soldiers lounged on its upper deck, and Garrity felt a chill in his belly when he looked at them. They were carrying Army-type, heavy-caliber carbine rifles. Some of the boys got up, but Garrity did not. Neither did Olson or Baker, and after his initial look, McBreeze seemed to have fallen back into his own thoughts. The skinny kid in the pine tree was swinging his feet idly. The major got out of the jeep. He was a tall, straight man with a deep desert tan that went well with his simple khakis. A pistol was strapped to his Sam Brown belt, and he was wearing reflector sunglasses. It was rumored that the major's eyes were extremely light-sensitive, and he was never seen in public without his sunglasses. "Sit down, boys," he said. "Keep Hint 13 in mind." Hint 13 was, conserve energy whenever possible. Those who had stood sat down. Garrity looked at his watch again. It said 8:16, and he decided it was a minute fast. The major always showed up on time. He thought momentarily of setting it back a minute and then forgot it. "I'm not going to make a speech," the major said, sweeping them with the blank lenses that covered his eyes. "I give my congratulations to the winner among your number, and my acknowledgments of valor to the losers." He turned to the back of the jeep. There was a living silence. Garrity breathed deep of the spring air. It would be warm, a good day to walk. The major turned back to them. He was holding a clipboard. "When I call your name, please step forward and take your number. Then go back to your place until it is time to begin. Do this smartly, please." "You're in the army now," Olson whispered with a grin. But Garrity ignored it. You couldn't help admiring the major. Garrity's father, before the squads took him away, had been fond of calling the major the rarest and most dangerous monster any nation can produce, a society-supported sociopath. But he had never seen the major in person. "Aronson." A short, chunky farm boy with a sunburned neck gangled forward, obviously awed by the major's presence, and took his large plastic one. He fixed it to his shirt by the pressure strip, and the major clapped him on the back. "Abraham." A tall boy with reddish hair in jeans and a t-shirt. His jacket was tied about his waist, schoolboy style, and flapped wildly around his knees. Olson sniggered. "Baker, Arthur." "That's me," Baker said and got to his feet. He moved with deceptive leisure, and he made Garrity nervous. Baker was going to be tough. Baker was going to last a long time. Baker came back. He had pressed his number 3 onto the right breast of his shirt. "Did he say anything to you?" Garrity asked. "He asked me if it was commencing to come off hot down home," Baker said shyly. "Yeah, the major talked to me." Not as hot as it's going to commence getting up here, Olson cracked.
Baker James, the major said. It went on until 8:40, and it came out right. No one had ducked out. Back in the parking lot, engines started, and a number of cars began pulling out. Boys from the backup list who would now go home and watch the long walk coverage on TV. It's on, Garrity thought. It's really on. When his turn came, the major gave him number 47 and told him, good luck. Up close, he smelled very masculine and somehow overpowering. Garrity had an almost insatiable urge to touch the man's leg and make sure he was real. Peter McBreeze was 61. Hank Olson was 70. He was with the major longer than the rest. The major laughed at something Olson said and clapped him on the back. I told him to keep a lot of money on short call, Olson said when he came back. And he told me to give him hell. Said he liked to see someone who was raring to rip. Give him hell, boy, he said. Pretty good, McBreeze said, and then winked at Garrity. Garrity wondered what McBreeze had meant, winking like that. Was he making fun of Olson? The skinny boy in the tree was named Stebbins. He got his number with his head down, not speaking to the major at all, and then sat back at the base of his tree. Garrity was somehow fascinated with the boy. Number 100 was a red-headed fellow with a volcanic complexion. His name was Zuck. He got his number, and then they all sat and waited for what would come next. Then three soldiers from the half-track passed out wide belts with snap pockets. The pockets were filled with tubes of high-energy concentrate pastes. More soldiers came around with canteens. They buckled on the belts and slung the canteens. Olson slung his belt low on his hips, like a gunslinger, found a wafer chocolate bar, and began to eat it. Not bad, he said, grinning. He swigged from his canteen, washing down the chocolate. And Garrity wondered if Olson was just fronting, or if he knew something Garrity did not. The major looked them over soberly. Garrity's wristwatch said 8:56. How had it gotten so late? His stomach lurched painfully. All right, fellows, line up by tens, please. No particular order. Stay with your friends, if you like. Garrity got up. He felt numb and unreal. It was as if his body now belonged to someone else. Well, here we go, McBreeze said at his elbow. Good luck, everyone. Good luck to you, Garrity said, surprised. McBreeze said, I need my fucking head examined. He looked suddenly pale and sweaty. Not so awesomely fit as he had earlier. He was trying to smile and not making it. The scar stood out on his cheek like a wild punctuation mark. Stebbins got up and ambled to the rear of the 10-wide, 10-deep queue. Olson, Baker, McBreeze, and Garrity were in the third row. Garrity's mouth was dry. He wondered if he should drink some water. He decided against it. He had never in his life been so aware of his feet. He wondered if he might freeze and get his ticket on the starting line. He wondered if Stebbins would fold early, Stebbins with his jelly sandwich and his purple pants. He wondered if he would fold up first. He wondered what it would feel like if his wristwatch said 8:59. The major was studying a stainless steel pocket chronometer. He raised his fingers slowly, and everything hung suspended with his hand. The 100 boys watched it carefully. And the silence was awful and immense. The silence was everything. Garrity's watch said 9 o'clock, but the poised hand did not fall. Do it. Why doesn't he do it? He felt like screaming it out. Then he remembered that his watch was a minute fast. You could set your watch by the major, only he hadn't. He had forgotten. The major's fingers dropped. Luck to all, he said. His face was expressionless, and the reflector sunglasses hid his eyes. They began to walk smoothly, with no jostling. Garrity walked with them. He hadn't frozen. Nobody froze. His feet passed beyond the stone marker, in parade step with McBreeze on his left and Olson on his right. The sound of feet was very loud. This is it. This is it. This is it. A sudden insane urge to stop came to him, just to see if they really meant business. He rejected the thought indignantly and a little fearfully. They came out of the shade and into the sun, the warm spring sun. It felt good. Garrity relaxed, put his hands in his pockets, and kept step with McBreeze, The group began to spread out, each person finding his own stride and speed. The half-track clanked along the soft shoulder, throwing thin dust. The tiny radar dishes turned busily, monitoring each walker's speed with a sophisticated onboard computer. Low-speed cutoff was exactly 4 miles an hour.
Warning! Warning, 88!
Garrity started and looked around. It was Stebbins. Stebbins was 88. Suddenly, he was sure Stebbins was going to get his ticket right here, still in sight of the starting post.
Smart, it was Olson.
What?
Garrity asked. He had to make a conscious effort to move his tongue.
The guy takes a warning while he's still fresh and gets an idea of where the limit is. And he can slough it easy enough. You walk an hour without getting a fresh warning, you lose one of the old ones. You know that.
Sure, I know it, Garrity said.
It was in the rule book. They gave you 3 warnings. The 4th time you fell below 4 miles an hour, you were... well, you were out of the walk. But if you had 3 warnings and could manage to walk for 3 hours, you were back in the sun again.
So now he knows, Olson said.
And at 10:02, he's in the clear again. Garrity walked on at a good clip. He was feeling fine. The starting post dropped from sight as they breasted a hill and began descending into a long pine-studded valley. Here and there were rectangular fields with the earth just freshly turned.
Potatoes, they tell me, McBree said.
Best in the world, Garrity answered automatically.
You from Maine? Baker asked.
Yeah, downstate. He looked up ahead. Several boys had drawn away from the main group, making perhaps 6 miles an hour. 2 of them were wearing identical leather jackets with what looked like eagles on the back. It was a temptation to speed up, but Garrity refused to be hurried. Conserve energy whenever possible. Hint 13.
Does the road go anywhere near your hometown?
McBreeze asked.
About 7 miles to one side. I guess my mother and my girlfriend will come to see me.
He paused and added carefully.
If I'm still walking, of course.
Well, there won't be 25 gone when we get downstate, Olson said. A silence fell among them at that. Garrity knew it wasn't so, and he thought Olson did, too. 2 other boys received warnings, and in spite of what Olson had said, Garrity's heart lurched each time he checked back on Stebbins. He was still at the rear and eating another jelly sandwich. There was a 3rd sandwich jutting from the pocket of his ragged green sweater. Garrity wondered if his mother had made them, and he thought of the cookies his own mother had given him, pressed on him, as if warding off evil spirits.
Why don't they let people watch the start of a long walk? Garrity asked.
Spoils the walker's concentration, a sharp voice said. Garrity turned his head. It was a small, dark, intense-looking boy with the number 5 pressed to the collar of his jacket. Garrity couldn't remember his name.
Concentration, he said.
Yes, the boy moved up beside Garrity. The major has said it is very important to concentrate on calmness at the beginning of a long walk. He pressed his thumb reflectively against the end of his rather sharp nose. There was a bright red pimple there.
I agree. Excitement, crowds, TV later. Right now, all we need to do is focus.
He stared at Garrity with his hooded dark brown eyes and said it again.
Focus.
All I'm focusing on is picking them up and laying them down, Olson said. 5 looked insulted. You have to pace yourself. You have to focus on yourself. You have to have a plan. I'm Garrett Barkovich, by the way. My home is Washington, D.C.
I'm John Carter, Olson said. My home is Barsoom, Mars.
Barkovich curled his lip in contempt and dropped back. There's one cuckoo in every clock, I guess, Olson said. But Garrity thought Barkovich was thinking pretty clearly, at least until one of the guards called out, "Warning! Warning! 5! About 5 minutes later.
I've got a stone in my shoe,
Barkovich said waspishly. The soldier didn't reply. He dropped off the half-track and stood on the shoulder of the road opposite Barkovich. In his hand he held a stainless steel chronometer just like the major's. Barkovich stopped completely and took off his shoe. He shook a tiny pebble out of it. Dark, intense, his olive sallow face shiny with sweat. He paid no attention when the soldier called out, 2nd warning, 5. Instead, he smoothed his sock carefully over the arch of his foot.
Uh-oh,
Olson said. They had all turned around and were walking backward. Stebbins, still at the tag end, walked past Barkovich without looking at him. Now Barkovich was all alone, slightly to the right of the white line, retying his shoe.
3rd warning, 5. Final warning.
There was something in Garrity's belly that felt like a sticky ball of mucus. He didn't want to look, but he couldn't look away. He wasn't conserving energy whenever possible by walking backward, but he couldn't help that either.
He could almost feel Barkovich's seconds shriveling away to nothing.
Oh, boy, Olson said. That dumb shit, he's going to get his ticket.
But then Barkovich was up. He paused to brush some road dirt from the knees of his pants. Then he broke into a trot, caught up with the group, and settled back into his walking pace. He passed Stebbins, who still didn't look at him, and caught up with Olson.
He grinned, brown eyes glittering.
See, I just got myself a rest. It's all in my plan.
Maybe you think so,
Olson said, his voice higher than usual. All I see that you got is three warnings. For your lousy minute and a half, you got to walk 3 fucking hours. And why in hell did you need a rest? We just started, for Christ's sake.
Barkovich looked insulted. His eyes burned at Olson. We'll see who gets his ticket first, you or me, he said.
It's all in my plan. Your plan and the stuff that comes out of my asshole bear a suspicious resemblance to each other, Olson said, and Baker chuckled. With a snort, Barkovich strode past them. Olson couldn't resist a parting shot. Just don't stumble, buddy. They don't warn you again, they just...
Barkovich didn't even look back, and Olson gave up, disgusted.
At 9:13 by Garrity's watch, he had taken the trouble to set it back to 1 minute, the Major's jeep breasted the hill they had just started down. He came past them on the shoulder opposite the pacing half-track and raised a battery-powered loudhailer to his lips. I'm pleased to announce that you have finished the first mile of your journey, boys. I'd also like to remind you that the longest distance a full complement of walkers has ever covered is 7¾ miles. I'm hoping you'll better that.
The jeep spurted ahead.
Olson appeared to be considering this news with startled, even fearful wonder.
Not even 8 miles, Garrity thought.
It wasn't nearly as far as he would have guessed. He hadn't expected anyone, not even Stebbins, to get a ticket until late afternoon, at least. He thought of Barkovich. All he had to do was fall below speed once in the next hour. End of Side 4. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.